Recordings have started. You may proceed.
Thank you. Good morning, good afternoon, and good evening, and welcome to the Review of All Rights Protection Mechanisms, RPM, and all GTLD's PDP Working Group call held on the 15th of November, 2017. In the interest of time, there'll be no roll call as we have quite a few participants. Attendance will be taken by the Adobe Connect room. If you are only on the audio bridge, could you please let yourselves be known now? Hearing no names, I would like to remind all to please state your name before speaking for transcription purpose, and to please keep your phones and microphones on mute when not speaking to avoid any background noise. With this, I'll turn it back over to our co-chair, Kathy Kleinman. Please begin.
Hello, everyone. Welcome back from Abu Dhabi for those who traveled there. This is Kathy Kleinman, Phil Corwin. Co-chair Phil Corwin is on the call, and J. Scott Evans, I believe, is on mute and will be joining us shortly via web. So we welcome you to the call and start with statements of interest. And I know there's at least one update to statements of interest out there, but perhaps there are others in this transition at end of year. Does anyone have an update to statement of interest? Phil, go ahead, please.
Thank you, Kathy. And it's good to be back from Abu Dhabi and back to work on RPMs. I think most of you know that a week ago Monday, I shut down my private law practice and assumed the position of policy counsel in VeriSign's legal department. So I'm now an employee of VeriSign, and in fact, I'm on the line from headquarters in Reston, Virginia. So I don't expect it to change my approach to administration of this working group as one of the co-chairs, but I have changed my SOI the other day at ICANN, and it reflects my new position and the fact that I'm now related to the contracted side of the house rather than the non-contract side. So that's it, and thanks to all for who have sent good wishes. I appreciate it.
Great. And let me add mine. Good luck in your new position, and very glad you're continuing as co-chair. Terrific. Any other updates to statement of interest? Okay. I'm actually going to add kind of a 1A to the agenda item to see if this time is working for everyone. We're now at, with the time change, we went from 1 p.m. Eastern to noon Eastern with similar changes percolating across the U.S. We were trying not to conflict with, I believe, registry calls or maybe registrar calls. Are we in conflict now with any stakeholder group calls, or is this a good time for everyone? I'll just pause for a second. If I don't hear any objections, the registry call immediately precedes this. Okay. Terrific. So this is a good time. So we'll be continuing at this new time. So a new time for some of us. Terrific. Then let us go. Actually, can we go back to the top of the slide, please, the slide deck? So what we're going to do is in Abu Dhabi, we began the review of the URS, the Uniform Rapid Suspension, and we started with slides, not these slides. We started with another set of slides that provide an overview of the URS, what the rules are, and how the rules operate. If you have questions about that, and there was a session that talked about some of the data that Barry Cobb had collected for us about the URS, we should probably recirculate that information again. But that was one of the discussions in Abu Dhabi. Then we reviewed the charter questions that were given to us by the GNSO Council. And could we go to the next slide, please? Next slide. So the charter questions that were given to us by the GNSO Council. Now, in the past, we split the subteams to review, edit, clarify, and consolidate the charter questions. But it actually seemed very productive in Abu Dhabi for us to move through the URS charter questions together. And we actually got through a pass of all of them. And so we're thinking, so the co-chairs thought, let's not go back to a sub-team for this. Let's keep this in plenary, keep it with the full working group, and maybe do a quick second pass through for those who participated, and we have staff notes that they'll be inserting of feedback as we went through the charter questions. And also for those who did not go to Abu Dhabi and chose not to get up at 1 o'clock or 5 o'clock in the morning to participate remotely, although thank you to everyone who did participate in person and remotely. So we're going to do another quick pass through the URS charter questions with staff as appropriate inserting proposals that came in and questions that came in from the working group in our Abu Dhabi meeting, and since then on the working group list. Let me pause. It looks like Brian Beckham would like to comment. Go ahead, Brian.
Hi, thanks, Kathy. Brian Beckham for the record. I guess I want to ask a question slash make a comment, which is, if I understand you, this is not the opportunity to propose changes to the wording of the charter questions, but merely to go through them. The reason I raise that is because I read through them last night in preparation for this call, and quite a number of them seemed like they would benefit from additional context. So I just want to make sure I understand, as we go through these questions now on the call, are we meant to, on a question-by-question basis, weigh in with substantive ideas on how to shape those questions to provide a little more context, or is this just kind of a pass to refresh our memories and we'll take a next step from there? Thanks.
Brian, that is a great question. Why don't you stay on the call for a second? No, the thought was that this is a second pass through, that this is absolutely the opportunity to provide edits and context. Because a number of people, I can see a number of people who are participating now did participate in the last call, but a number of people in the last meeting on the charter questions, but a number of people didn't. So this is absolutely the opportunity to provide edits and context.
Okay, thanks. Well, could I briefly react? I'll happily do that during this call. May I suggest that we, just to sort of give people a chance, I looked at these last night, and to be frank, I'm not sure we're going to get very far if we're going to be providing substantive comments on the questions as we run through them today. So maybe to kind of think about, do we want to open up for discussion on the email list or in the next one or two calls, and to kind of give ourselves a little bit of a point in time to work towards, to give ourselves on the one hand a goal and on the other hand a limitation, so that it doesn't become a completely open-ended exercise, but to give people sufficient time to get their heads around these questions and shape them in the best way possible to actually take the work forward from there.
That makes sense. That makes sense. Christine, you're next in line. Thank you.
Hi, thanks. This is Christine, for the record. I am assuming that even though we're working with the full working group, that we're going to do what we've done for the other working groups as a sub-team so far, which is to go through the charter questions, put them in a table using the original charter questions in the left-hand column,
Christine,
and then in the middle column...
Christine, this is Kathy. Let me interrupt. You're very muffled.
Is that any better?
A little bit.
I'm sorry.
Very slowly we may be able to understand.
Okay, I'm going to quickly see if I can adjust my headset here.
Is
that any better on your end?
You'll have to keep talking when you're testing. Keep going.
Okay, I don't know if that's any better on your end or not. I'm adjusting the volume. I don't know. That might just be on my end.
It's a little clearer, but a little lower to me. Brian Beckham is saying it's still muffled.
Okay. You know what? Why don't I just quickly dial in? I'll be right back.
Okay. Terrific. While Christine is redialing in, does anyone have any comments? And let's move to the next slide, please. Okay. So as we're waiting for Christine to dial back in, this is a slide with questions that came to us, again, from the council, response involving the URS, involving response to complaints, defenses, standards of proof. So Christine, let us know when we're back in. Okay, thanks, Derek. Brian, did you have something else you wanted to say? Your hand is still raised. Thanks. No problem. Okay. As we're waiting for Christine, maybe I can ask Julie or Mary to read through the questions. Again, we've already touched on them once. We do have some edits, but we don't quite have a table yet, and maybe it would be useful to everyone to have a table where we're looking at the initial questions as well as whatever additional questions, clarifications, edits, and context were raised to them. But we don't have that table right now. Mary, Julie, do you want to quickly run us through the slide?
Hi, Kathy. This is Julie Hedlund from staff. Happy to run through the slide while we're waiting for Christine to get back through. Oh, Christine says she's back. Do we want to revert to Christine, or would you like me to read through this?
Okay, and then we'll go back to going through the charter questions. Christine, go ahead, please.
Hi, thanks. Everybody can hear me better, I hope.
Much better.
Okay, fantastic. I will re-troubleshoot the new headset now. Cool. I just wanted to follow up because I know I've been a participant in all of the sub-teams so far, and we've kind of followed the same process. And I wanted to clarify and see if we were planning to follow the same process, which is that, and I know that we're not using a special sub-team, but I'm assuming we're going to follow the same process that the sub-teams have followed, which is to keep all of the charter questions in the left-hand column of a table, and then in the middle column, we can add sort of our edits or changes to those questions, things that would help clarify, things that would provide some context. I know to address Brian's point, in every sub-team so far, we've lacked context. We've had to send Mary or staff for why a particular charter question is even listed so we could try to figure out what the problem is so we can make sure the question is worded properly. And then, of course, from there, at the bottom of that, adding any new additional questions that have come up as a result of our discussions. Is that the plan going forward? And I apologize if you stated that and I missed it, but I just want to clarify if we're tending to follow the same sort of established process we've done on the three sub-teams so far, even though this is the full working group. Thank you.
Great question, and yes, that is the intent. That's my understanding of the intent, is that we are going to go through, and in fact, my first response when I looked at the materials was, I think we need a table. So we're all kind of in the same mode of how we work through the charter questions, and I'm really glad you raised it, that we keep all the charter questions on the left side, that we go through edits and changes in a different column, and that we look at new questions. And fortunately for us, the URS charter only had the working group charter for the URS questions only had 13 questions. So our starting point is many fewer questions than we were looking at in other areas. So it's a limited starting point. If we choose to expand it, you know, that would be our choice. And also, as we go through the questions, we should, of course, be thinking, as we did in the sub-teams, about data gathering. We're not going to be talking about it yet. That will be a later call. And that may indeed go to a sub-team if we decide it's too time-consuming for the main working group. But data gathering is also, of course, one of the steps farther on in the process. So thanks for outlining that, Christine. And we have staff who are going to review the charter questions with us and keep notes as we go through. And if we find that everything that was, you know, needed to be raised, either that these are good questions or that everything needed to be raised already in Abu Dhabi, we can move forward more quickly. But this should bring everybody up to a level playing field on the issues and on the charter questions. So, Brian, go ahead, please.
Thanks, Kathy. Brian Beckham again. I'm happy to go along with the will of the working group here, but I just wanted to raise, again, this is my looking at the questions last night. If it's best that we look at this together in plenary, then that's fine. I just wanted to raise one concern that might be a little unwieldy versus doing some kind of a document exchange over email. For my part, the questions, I'm just looking at the first page here of the charter questions, and I have an awful lot of notes in the margins. So I'm not too optimistic that we'll get very far on any individual call, but that may be the best way forward, and that way we can kind of fully air questions or concerns about the charter questions. But just wanted to raise whether we collectively think this is the most efficient way forward, or whether whether the sub-team approach might be worth considering. Again, I don't have particularly strong feelings, but thought it's worth us considering. Thanks.
Okay. And of course, for lengthy materials, you can post with discussion to the working group, and then staff can cut and paste and incorporate into the tables that they'll be creating. I should say this was a discussion of the co-chairs that we stay in plenary right now. But speaking of co-chairs, let me call on Phil Corwin.
Yeah, thank you, Kathy. These are personal views right now. I think we're all, those of us who were particularly in Abu Dhabi, and some of us were tied up with the Intel Leadership Conference last week, and then one of us is trying to get used to an entirely new job. The co-chairs have not had an opportunity yet since ICANN 60 to be on a call together with staff. We're in a period here in phase one of our work where we need to consult with staff on the status of moving our data survey forward as quickly as possible so we can return to trademark claims and Sunrise registrations as soon as possible with the benefit of the data we get back and the analysis of that data. But that's going to be a while. We have to get a firm grip on what time period we're talking about. But that means that we have a significant amount of time before that data will be back that we can devote to a thorough vetting of URS. So one of the considerations is while these questions are being defined, made neutral, additional questions being proposed, if that went to a sub-team, what would the full working group do? One way to handle that might just be to say we're going to be, the agenda for the next few calls is going to be that vetting process, and those who want to be on should be on, and those who want to leave it to others to refine the questions can pass on those calls. It might be a distinction without a difference for between that process and a sub-team. But mostly I'm saying that we're just reorganizing here, and I think we should use this session to review the questions, and then the co-chairs, we welcome feedback from all the members on what the best way to proceed is given the time we have before us to devote to URS, whether working group members to prefer a sub-team approach or a full vetting by the full working group with participation by those who are interested in question refinement and addition. And we're going to wind up in the same place, which is having a final set of questions, hopefully after a few weeks, maybe by the end of the year, maybe early in January, and then proceeding to identify the data needs and other things we need to answer those questions. So I hope that's helpful from the perspective of one who's just getting reorganized after the whirlwind of ICANN 60 and getting back on back up to speed back stateside now that I'm back. So I'll stop there and hope that was of some benefit. Thank you.
Great benefit. Thanks, Phil, and thanks for summarizing kind of the online discussion of the co-chairs. We have lots of people on the call today, 40 participants. So absent any further objections, or concerns, which I'll wait for, let's go forward. And Brian, thank you for reemphasizing that we shouldn't be moving on, that our first pass in Abu Dhabi was really just a first pass, and that this all, the substantive questions deserve a second pass as we look at them and analyze them, again, for edits, context, clarification, and consolidation. Okay. Let me turn it back to Julie to review the questions on slide 1 of 5. Julie, go ahead, please.
Thank you very much, Kathy. This is Julie Hedlund from staff. So I'm on slide 4 for those who may not be in the room, but I think most are, and this is slide 1 of 5 of the URS charter questions. These are questions that relate to responses to complaints, defenses, and standard of proof. The first one of 4 on the slides, the first question is, should the ability for defaulting respondents in URS cases file a reply for an extended period, e.g. up to 1 year after the default notice or even after a default determination is issued, in which case the complaint could be reviewed anew, be changed. Now, Kathy, I have to ask, do you want me to pause after reading these, or do you want me to just summarize them? How would you, or should I just read all of them on this slide?
Yes, go ahead and read all of them on the slide, please, because since this is a second pass, I'm not sure we have to go through one by one the way we did in Abu Dhabi. So if you could read the other three, that would
I'll read all of them on the slide. Thank you very much, Kathy, and this is Julie again. The next question was, should the response fee applicable to complainants, listing 15 or more disputed domain names by the same registrant be eliminated? Third bullet, is the URS's clear and convincing standard of proof appropriate? And fourth, are the expanded defenses of the URS being used, and if so, how, when, and by whom? And another question for you, Kathy, is staff could also read out the comments that we did get at ICANN 60 on a couple of these questions, if that's helpful, just let me know.
Yes, that might be helpful.
Okay, and I see that Paul has asked for the slides to be unlocked. They are unlocked now, so you can go through them yourself. Kathy, I see Brian has his hand up.
Susan has her hand up. Susan, go ahead, please.
Heard.
Susan, if you're speaking, you may still be on mute. Okay, Susan hasn't dialed in yet. Well, let's pause. Actually, before we read additional material, let's pause to take a look at comments to the questions, and let's go down. So first question, as Julie read, should the ability for defaulting respondents in URS cases to file a reply for an extended period after the default notice be changed, and other wording as well. So should we be changing the process? And, well, let me ask, does anyone have any comments on any of these questions since we're looking at them as a block right now? I do know that questions and a lot of additional material has been submitted about clear and convincing evidence, and so there will be different questions on that. Phil and then Brian. Go ahead, Phil.
Yeah, thanks, Kathy. In considering this first question, I think we might use this second review to get a little more into the details of what happens here and what the thinking was that when the URS was created for these provisions. So this question relates to there's a URS filed. We know there's a short reply period, which can be extended by up to 1 week, but that takes some response from the domain registrant. So if this is a default case, no response. There's a determination, let's presume, against the registrant. So what is after that, and this is a question I don't know the answer to, and I think we want to refamiliarize ourselves with the process and whether it makes sense. After that, is it 1 year from the filing of the URS? I guess that's the logical reading. And so 10 months go by, the registrant's lost a default determination. Let's assume the domain was registered for a period where it's still up and running and hasn't gone back in the pool. What's the effect of filing this reply after many months, and is that a good policy decision? That's the question I'd want to focus. What's the practical effect of this? I can understand, given the short time period, that we want to give a registrant who may not have gotten a timely notice or wasn't able to secure counsel in that short time some leeway, but I think the question is, one, is a year necessary, and two, what's the effect after whatever the time period is of filing this reply? Does it revive everything and require a second panel decision? So that's what I had. Thanks.
Terrific. Thanks for both the context and the clarification of questions. I trust staff is and see that staff is copying that for our table, you know, as well as the data gathering question. Of course, have people been using this? That would be interesting as well. Brian, go ahead, please.
I put my question in the chat. Thanks.
Okay. Should this be broken up into different questions? Good question. Claudia, go ahead, please.
Thanks, Kathy. So my question was, are we also at this stage providing additional questions that might fall under this category of standard approved defenses and response to complaints? Or are we just focusing on tweaks to what's already listed here on the slide?
There was certainly a public outreach, or the intent was to have a public outreach in Abu Dhabi. So unless there are any objections, I would think we're open to additional questions that are related to this category, and we'll put them under a separate section for evaluation. They don't automatically come in, but they're for evaluation by the working group. Because we've certainly had proposed additional questions coming out on the list after ICANN 60, and those are part of our materials. So we're still in the period where additional questions can be offered.
Okay. All right. Great. So should I provide that now?
Certainly. If you want to type it in, do you want to provide it on the call right now, or do you want to?
Go
ahead, please.
One issue, I believe, relating to standard of proof that came up, and I think there's certainly a little crossover in terms of how we categorize these questions. There is a provision in the ERS for abusive complaints that are filed by trademark owners, and I think there's something in there that says if there are over 3 abusive complaint filed, that there might be some restrictions on the ability of the trademark owner to file further complaints. In the context of that particular issue, something that was discussed was should there be something similar on the flip end for respondents or registrants who might be abusively registering domains. And within that discussion, one compromise proposal that was put forward was shifting the burden of proof. So if the respondent has lost 5 or more proceedings, the standard of proof, the burden would be shifted, and it would then be on the respondent to meet the burden of proof. So that would be the particular question I had in mind. Thank you.
Terrific. And I'm going to ask staff to hold that, Claudio, until we get to slide 3 of 5, which deals, because of the different categories, 3 of 5 is titled Misuse, Repeat Offenders Language. And I think what you're saying would fit into there. So flagging it, and thank you for doing that. So we are still on slide 1 of 5, response to complaints, defenses, standards of proof. Susan, go ahead, please.
Yeah, hi, it's Susan Payne. Apologies about earlier. I could hear everyone fine, and I completely forgot that I hadn't connected my audio. I just wanted to mention that obviously one of the things that we did when we worked in sub teams on the other charter questions was that we tried to revise questions for, or rather, you know, keeping the original question, but also suggesting an alternative version that was more neutral. And a couple of the questions on this slide, seem to me to be reasonably neutral. The first one I'm not entirely sure of. I kind of would need to get my head around it a bit better. But, I mean, the second one's not terribly neutral at the moment. In terms of, it's only talking about the fee in one sense. It's not, for example, talking about, should there be a response fee for any response for example. Now, I don't necessarily, personally, I don't necessarily want to start trying to draft on the hoof whilst we're on the call, although if that's what is expected, then I guess we can do that. But I just wanted to flag that there is that exercise of neutrality that's required, and I wouldn't want us to get to the end of this supposed second pass and be told that that's it, we're done. Because I think there's work needed to be done about neutrality and so on.
Okay. Thank you for the comments, Susan. We have done some neutrality work. We've certainly done neutrality work in the past.
Jonathan,
we do have that balance. Sorry. We do have that balance between trying to move forward and, you know, how much we want to edit. Petter, go ahead, please.
Thanks, Petter. Just a practical proposal. If it would be more easy to read and understand so that we are clear on which part of the URS that each question refers to have just a short note or reference to the specific part of the URS added to each question. I know that we all have the full documents, but it could be good when we discuss it, and also so that everybody else outside the group can understand what each question refers to.
You haven't memorized every subpoint, neither have I. That's a very good recommendation, Petter, and I hope staff will put that into, and I'd ask staff to put that into the next table. Claudio and then Jay Scott.
Thanks, Kathy. So I think, again, this would possibly fall under the first slide. I'm looking at it as a potential scope issue, the scope of the URS. This was actually something that I think came up on the CCT review team. They, I think, put forward a proposal that, if not the URS, but there could be a mechanism to address abusively registered domains that are not necessarily identical or confusingly similar to a trademark. To the extent that's something that could fall under the URS, and to the extent it relates to the scope of the rights protection mechanism, I think the issue would be, should the first element be modified to include domains that are abusively registered that may not be identical or confusingly similar to a trademark? Thank you.
Okay. I'm going to divide that into two, Claudio, and others can disagree with me, but it seems like we're reviewing the rights protection mechanisms as they exist. That's our first mandate, and then changing them would be a second call. So we should separate and clarify that in our questions, the questions that are directed towards review versus the questions that are directed towards change. But with that said, let's add that suggestion into the discussion. Jay Scott, go ahead, please, and glad you're online now.
Hi, can you hear me?
Yes, we can.
Okay, first of all, I think Jonathan Mikowski spoke up, and I want to make sure that we get him in queue. If he still wants to be in queue, I don't know if he has the ability to raise his hand, so I'm just going to write that. Second, I'm wondering if what we don't want to do is go through all these questions and then put them into buckets on what issue they are specifically trying to address. And then, once we identify the problem, so, you know, questions 4, 6, and 7 are trying to address X, you know, and then we refine those into neutral questions that will get us information to allow us to have solutions or propose recommendations for solutions that would address the issue. Because as Mary pointed out and has pointed out several times, one of the things that has hampered our work is these questions have never been vetted by anyone. They were all just scooped up out of public comments and other submissions with regards to other things around RPMs and dumped into this document. And so they do come with points of view, with agendas, with others, as they should. They were written by advocates for particular positions. But it's our job then to drill down and the what are we trying to solve for, and then take those questions, and because I think the questions do a better job of identifying issues and problems with the process than they do in actually asking questions that will get us information to allow us to propose recommended solutions. That's just my two cents.
Jay Scott, before you leave the call, I hope you're still on. It looks like, you know, staff did that first pass at creating buckets. That's why we have, you know, this slide is response to complaints, defenses, standards of proof. The next slide is remedies, appeals, costs. Next slide is misuse, repeat offenders. And then we have some slides about questions about providers and knowledge about by participants. Are you talking about different types of buckets, or are you recommending we stay with those buckets?
I'm fine with staying with those buckets. Let's just get consensus that those buckets are fine, then move on and take the first group, and then begin to look at how we can take question one, which I put in the comment, seems extremely convoluted. And it could be, you know, a simple question with regards to, you know, should timing mechanisms be changed? Within the current timing mechanisms be changed. And then you can do a list of the timing mechanisms that are in there that are raised here. But the question, you get lost in this question. And I'm an English speaker, and I get lost in this question. And with an international audience, I think it's very convoluted, and I think there are a way to get to the heart of what the question is asking, but make it much more easy to follow and understand, and I think that's what we're trying to do. I'm fine with the buckets. Let's get everybody on this call to vote. If we're fine, or we have consensus on the buckets that staff has done, thank you, staff, then I think our next thing is to go into each bucket and then start looking at the question and start taking for suggestions on how we can either, as Brian Beckham has pointed out, provide context to it or simplify it so that we have a neutral question seeking information that will allow us to craft recommended solutions.
Thank you very much. That makes sense. It looks like there's support for what you're saying. I'm going to recommend we do a lot of this on the list, because if we're editing, well, first we're going to need the table to work with, and then editing online with a full working group probably is going to be difficult. But is there any objection to using the buckets that we've got that have been created by staff? They put a good amount of time into creating this, which we appreciate. So we'll use those buckets. Let me pause. It looks like Jonathan Mutkowski was trying to speak up, so let me pause if he's on audio and see if there's something he wants to add.
Thanks. I've been struggling to get into Adobe Connect, so I apologize in advance. But I don't have the slides in front of me. I'm looking for them on the wiki right now. Just as background to the question that I would like to propose to the group, under the UDRP, you know, when allegations are entitled to some weight, and when a respondent defaults, inferences are drawn, and that's typically done as a matter of jurisprudence, like a body of the case law that's been developed over the years. In the context of the URS, for this goes specifically to the standard of proof for clear and convincing evidence. I'm not sure whether or not we should continue to leave it to the, you know, to a developing body of jurisprudence, or we should potentially add a clarification, depending on how we come out as a group on the issue, add a clarification to the rules as to whether or not allegations, bare bone allegations, are entitled to any weight in a complaint when, you know, when there's a default, when the other side doesn't show up. So should inferences of any kind be drawn? So even though the standard of proof is clear and convincing, should the panel give any weight to an allegation that goes uncontested in a default proceeding? Thank you.
Great. Thank you, Jonathan. And okay, sounds like a question to be captured, as well as a question perhaps to be asked to the URS providers about how this is being treated now. Okay, it looks like
the way it's being treated now is it's not specified in the rules, and it's inconsistent at best you know, allegations. I think it's because there hasn't just been a body. And I might be wrong. I haven't read every case. So, yes, it would be good to get other people's input. But I know in at least some cases, allegations are not entitled, are not given any weight, even when they're even when they go uncontested. And that that might be because, you know, the standard of proof overall is clear and convincing. As to whether or not, you know, in meeting that overall standard, certain allegations should be entitled to weight. You know, that's really a whether we want to add that to the rules. That's really a question for the group.
Okay. So, do you want to put something? We've captured some of your thoughts now. Do you want to add more on this to the list and see if we can capture it into the table?
I don't think there's anything more. We captured the question I just put forth. I think we're good. Thanks.
Okay. Thank you very much. Okay. It looks like we can move on to the next slide. Again, kind of in the broad brush, and thank you, everyone, for confirming that we did not get this all done in Abu Dhabi, that this is a useful exercise to go back through this again. Okay, if everyone could move to slide 2 or 5, which is slide number 5. Julie, back to you.
Thank you very much, Kathy, and this is Julie Hedlund from staff. Then, again, on slide 5. Which is 2 of 5 of the charter questions. These are those that relate to remedies, appeals, and costs. The first bullet is, should the URS allow for additional remedies, such as a perpetual block or other remedy, e.g. transfer or a quote-unquote right of first refusal to register the domain name in question? Next bullet, is the current length of suspension to the balance of the registration period sufficient? Third bullet, how can the appeals process of the URS be expanded and improved? Fourth, is the cost allocation model for the URS appropriate and justifiable? And fifth, should there be a loser pays model? If so, how can that be enforced if the respondent does not respond? Thank you.
Okay, so the bucket here is remedies, appeals, costs. Thanks very much, Julie. George, you're first in the queue.
George Kirikos for the transcript. Thanks. I don't have any comment on those questions, but I have a new question to add, or a new issue to add, that would fall, I guess, under the appeals category. This is actually an issue that arose in the IGO working group and applies to both the UDRP and the URS. And to put into context, one of the assumptions of both the UDRP and the URS is that either side can go to court, and the UDRP and the URS don't create new law. They just are an alternative mechanism for handling the disputes. And so there's an underlying assumption that actually both sides can go to court. Now, clearly, for the trademark holder, they have a cause of action for trademark infringement, and going to court isn't an issue. But we've seen in a couple of jurisdictions, namely Australia and the UK, that there have been some isolated cases where the courts have said that the respondent in the UDRP, namely the domain name owner, has no right to appeal the UDRP. And those are very disturbing decisions because it attacks the underlying assumption of the UDRP and the URS that court action is available to the domain name holder, and that respondents don't gain any new rights by initiating a UDRP or a URS first. So they don't gain any tactical advantage, so to speak, that the same dispute could be heard in a court first or second, and there'd be no prejudice due to the UDRP or the URS having been filed first. And so the question is, you know, what to do if a court determines that there's no right to review the UDRP or the URS decision. And I noticed in the chat, you know, you can seek a declaration of non-infringement in the UK. But there have been some decisions saying that they're not even going to hear the case because there's no cause of action. And Paul Keating brought up this issue in the IGO working group, and you know, respondents have, you know, are suffering in the UK and in Australia because of this. So we need to first investigate whether this is a problem, and I think it is, at least in a couple of jurisdictions. And if it is a problem, how to handle it. You know, perhaps the URS or the UDRP decision needs to be set aside so that the, you know, respondent has full due process, you know, forcing the trademark holder to file properly in the mutual jurisdiction under trademark action, et cetera. So that's my problem or issue that needs to be added to this section of the questions. Thank you.
George, did you want to submit that in a few lines? Because, you know, I could see that this would be a, you know, a distinct issue in the IGO-INGO working group. And it is an issue that, of course, has been raised about the lack of access due to lack of cause of action under national law involving different types of UDRP and URS issues.
Yeah, it's not an issue isolated to IGOs. It's an issue that was brought up in the working group. It's an issue for any domain holder. I think the yoyo.email people were one of the examples that, where the course, the case was thrown out, and apparently it's happening in Australia as well. So it's basically, it's an underlying assumption of the UDRP and the URS that either side can go to court. If that underlying assumption is, it proves false, then what do we do?
A good question. So I'm hoping staff has captured this, and that you also submit it in writing, as you know, so that we have kind of your phrasing on this to go into the table. Thanks, Claudio. Remedies, appeals, costs. Go ahead, please.
Thanks, Kathy. So just a wordsmithing comment on the first question. I would suggest changing it. So it reads, should the URS allow for additional remedies? And where it says perpetual block, I think we should change that to suspension, because, you know, block could mean something else. And I think what's intended here is that the suspension would be indefinite. That's the main comment, but there's just some repetition the way it's phrased here, because it says for additional remedies such as perpetual suspension or other remedies. So it's kind of repeating remedies twice, and we might just want to say, should the URS allow for additional remedies, comma, e.g. a perpetual suspension, transfer, or right of first refusal. Thank you.
Okay. Thanks for that clarification comment on the idea of changing block to suspension, which is, of course, one of the terms that is used in the URS. Sounds like a good one to me. Paul McGrady, go ahead, please.
Thanks, Kathy. Paul McGrady here. I just want to nip something in the bud before we get too far down the road. George kept talking about the URS and the UDRP. The UDRP is for phase two, not phase one. And we don't want to go down the path of only evaluating the UDRP during phase one. I'm sorry, I think I got that confused. UDRP is phase two, not phase one. We don't want to go down the path of accidentally reviewing the URP during phase one, because that's not what the charter says, and that's not what we're doing right now. And so I understand George has a concern, but I think in future we need to be very crystal clear that right now we are talking about the URS and not the UDRP. And we do not want to conflate them, I think that we need to be very careful in that space. That having been said, in relationship to the URS issue that George raised, I don't know of any cases anywhere saying URS decisions cannot be appealed. George may know that for URS. Again, not talking about UDRP, because this is not phase two. But even if such a case does exist in a jurisdiction outside of the U.S., the really simple solution here is simply to make the federal courts in the United States one of the appeals jurisdiction, because in the U.S., the ACPA is very independent of ICANN rights protection mechanisms, and courts will allow you to, you know, file under the ACPA's reverse domain name hijacking provisions if you happen to have a case. So that's a quick, easy fix. Thank you, George, for raising the issue. But I do, even though it's a fairly easy fix on the issue that he raised, I do think we need to be careful not to conflate ERS with UDRP. Thanks.
Thanks, Paul, for your comment, although we're going to see as we go down into our other charter questions that people did ask, there were some questions that did raise URS and UDRP. And of course, you know, what we need to do is file that question away when we get to the UDRP, as well as applying it to the URS as appropriate. But thanks, and if you have an answer to the issue, that's great too. Jeff, go ahead, please.
Thanks, Kathy, and I apologize. There's some noise in the background here, so hopefully it's not too loud. This is Jeff Newman. I'm going to try to go back to my Newman role at the high level here. And I want to make sure we're kind of all on the same page about this because I'm not sure we are. A lot of these questions, whether it's on this slide or even the past slides on complaints, defenses, standard of proof, et cetera, a lot of these questions were raised and answered or responded to, or the subject of compromise between the years of 2009 and 2012. What I'm afraid of is that we're going to get into the business of litigating these things, if you will, maybe that's not the right word, from a philosophical standpoint, as opposed to relying on actual cases or where evidence has shown there to be an issue. So things like, you know, is clear and convincing standard proof appropriate on one of the previous slides? These have been discussed and subject to compromise, et cetera. If we can show that based on its implementation that it's proven to be a problem and we need to readdress it, then by all means, let's readdress it. But I want to make sure we're not just readdressing things for the sake of readdressing. And so what that means is it's going to be important for context as to why something is the way it is, and also a realization that it was subject to a compromise potentially for a particular reason, and that philosophical debate of, you know, whether clear and convincing is the right standard or looking at the next slide as you know, should there be a loser pays model or even the previous slides before that on other things. We need to be sure that when we discuss these issues, number one, we need to get all of the context for why a provision is the way it is, which includes all of the previous debates and why we came out the way we did, and then look to see if there were any problems caused by that. The extent that there were problems, absolutely, let's address. If there are no problems yet that we've seen, then my recommendation is that there's no need to address because it's purely philosophical, and then those can be crossed off the list. So I want to make sure that we're kind of all in agreement as a group that that's the way we should proceed before we actually, you know, work on editing these questions and doing all sorts of work that could take us months down the path of looking at things that may not have shown to be problems yet. Thanks.
Jeff, hold on just a second. This is Kathy. This is valuable insight because you're doing this, of course, with another working group. So are you saying, and let me try some different words and see if it means the same thing, that you know, as a review team, we should be reviewing first the existing rules to see whether they're effective, whether they're used, whether they have problems. And from there, look at what the problems are and then think about the solutions versus looking at changes that are being suggested up front. Is that another way of saying what you're saying, or is that different?
Well, it's a good question. And recognizing the wording you're trying to get me to say, to the extent that it was established GNSO policy, to the extent that certain language is there because it was a compromise that was agreed to by the community, we should not be then relitigating those issues. If something was a decision, let's say, in an unrelated group that I know you're referring to, which was passed by top down from the board, as opposed to a community.
Actually, no, I wasn't even thinking of closed generics. Actually, I wasn't.
But,
so we really have to deal with that here. I was just trying to rephrase what you were saying in some of the words because I was thinking of the same issue, which is what's our starting point and what
right.
are we
so,
looking
so
at initially?
From that perspective, to the extent that a lot of these things were actually the subject of compromise, we should make sure that we look back at how we got to where we were. And to the extent it was decided by the community that we should proceed during in one way, we should not be readdressing those issues and just, you know, as another chance to litigate because we didn't like the way it was originally. We need to show that there was a problem or that the original assumptions made by the group did not turn out to be correct. And you know what? It turned out, you know, in Christine's email, she said, you know, I don't understand the provision that says that registrants shouldn't be allowed to change their content. And you know what? Upon rethinking it, it's a problem because registrars can't, or registries can't actually prevent a registrant from changing content. You know, that's one thing. That's a problem. But just, you know, relitigating a clear and convincing standard because we didn't like the way it initially was, that's the type of thing we should avoid.
Terrific. Thanks for raising this, Jeff, and articulating it so clearly and in context. And it also would make our job much easier and faster, frankly. It looks like Jay Scott agrees, if I'm reading his comment directly, correctly. I think Jeff is saying that we need to identify a problem caused by the current policy. If it is simply we do not like the policy or a part of the policy is written, then we do not need to renegotiate. Okay, that's Jay Scott. So let me call on our third co-chair, Phil Corwin. Phil, go ahead, please.
Thank you, Kathy, and two quick comments. One, I'm in general agreement with what Jeff just said. The URS was, you know, on this question that here, I think the word appropriate is the wrong word, and we need to rephrase this question. The standard is there because URS was created for black and white cases that can be handled rapidly with very short word limits on the complaint and the reply, something where kind of know it when you see it, and not shades of gray cases. So I'd be personally more interested in finding out whether the accredited providers have been following the standard. I'll assume they are, but, you know, I'll adopt the Ronald Reagan standard, trust but verify. We ought to look at some of those cases and make sure they're sticking to the standard. But let's presume that they are, then it wouldn't seem to be a barrier or creating a problem. But, yeah, we should focus more on identifying problems or failures to adhere to the policy as adopted rather than relitigating debates that took place years ago. The other matter I wanted to comment on was the one brought up by George and commented by Paul within our IGO working group and where I'm a co-chair. Yes, we have discovered that the U.S. is one of just a few jurisdictions that has a law like the ACPA that allows registrants to go to court and litigate their rights in their domains. ICANN has no power to create those rights in other jurisdictions. The reason so many registrants from outside the U.S. can get ACPA review is that they use a U.S.-based registrar, which creates gives them mutual jurisdiction. The one thing I dissent from was that Paul's simple and easy suggestion of making access to U.S. courts available for all registrants. I'd be wary of that one because of the ongoing debate on ICANN jurisdiction in the accountability, where I can imagine a lot of raised eyebrows at that. I've heard that some members of the GAC want to continue that jurisdiction debate even beyond Workstream 2 of the accountability work. So I think there's some political considerations on that suggestion. Whether UDRP should have an internal appeals mechanism is something we can deal with when and if we get to it. It's not relevant to the Phase 1 discussion. Thank you.
Thanks so much for your input, Phil. Appreciate it. And quick note, let's not spend too much time coming up with solutions until we come up with the questions. Paul, go ahead, please, and then let's move on to slide 3 of 5. Paul, go ahead, please.
Thanks, Kathy. Paul McCready here for the record. They'll be very quick. Just a response to Phil Corwin's comment, which is, I guess I don't understand why it would be a problem if the U.S. is one of the few places that has a right of appeal. It seems to me that that would reinforce ICANN's jurisdiction in the U.S., not make it a political problem. Of course, all jurisdictions are more than capable of developing ACPA-like legislation if they would like to do that. Thanks.
Cool. Thank you, Paul. Phil, go ahead, please.
If I could just very quickly respond. My concern is that if we established in this area that a domain name registrant in country X, who used a resident in country X, who used a registrar in country X, nonetheless has rights to proceed in court in the United States because ICANN administers the domain name system, I can imagine many matters, members of the GAC going completely apoplectic over that and creating a lot of problems on a jurisdiction issues that have been mostly dealt with successfully. So that's the reason for my concern. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you for the preview of discussions both for the URF and the UDRP. Okay, moving on to, let's see, we've got another 25 minutes. Let's see if we can get through the charter questions one more time, which we should be able to. We've just got a few more slides, and review everything so that people can go online, think about it. We can work with the tables. Julie, to you on URS charter questions, slide 3 of 5, if you could walk us through them, please.
Thank you very much, Kathy. This is Julie Hedlund from staff. So on slide 6, questions 3 of 5, these relate to misuse, repeat offenders, and language. Bullet 1 is what sanctions should be allowed for misuse of the URS by the trademark owner? 2, is there a need to develop express provisions to deal with repeat offenders, as well as a definition of what qualifies as repeat offenses? Bullet 3, has ICANN done its job in training registrants in the new rights and defenses of the URS? And bullet 4, what evidence is there of problems with the use of the English-only requirement of the URS, especially given its application to IDN new GTLDs? Thank you.
Great. Thank you, Julie. This is Kathy again, of course. So, in light of the discussion we've just had over the last few minutes, I'm glad to see that some of these questions here apply to how is the URS being, how is the URS being handled? What are the problems under the existing URS that people might be having, say with English only, and how to better prepare people for using the URS? That sounds, central to our review task, so that's good. With that said, let me turn over to Jeff and then to George. Paul, are you still in the queue, or is that an old hand? Old hand. Go ahead, Jeff.
Yeah, thanks. I think, and again, I'm not sure how we're using this session, but on the first question here, I really think there are precursors to this, right, which is, is there any evidence of misuse of the U.S. by trademark owners, number one. Number two is, as I forgot who pointed out in the chat because it's now kind of passed by, but there are sanctions that are in the URS for abusing. And so the question really should be what additional sanctions or have the existing sanctions been seen to be ineffective or, whatever it is. But this is one of those questions that builds in assumptions for which I think there are precursors that need to be answered before we even get to a question like this. Thanks.
Terrific. Thank you for your comments, and hopefully staff is catching some of those precursors, as you call them, which would get to, reviewing the existing process, as you pointed out, through the old compromises that were created before we look at whether we need to revise anything. George, go ahead, please.
George Kourikos again for the transcript. For the last question, I think the specificity with regards to IDNs is actually relatively minor, because if we look at the quantity of IDN registrations, they haven't been significant. However, the much more significant matter is that Chinese domain name registrants across all UGTLDs has been more than half, I think, statistically. I can't remember the exact statistics at present, but that's a much more major concern rather than IDN registrations. Thank you.
Terrific. Thank you, George. Let's go on to the next slide, URS charter questions 4 or 5. Julie, go ahead, please.
Thank you very much, Kathy. This is Julie Hedlund from staff. Slide 4 or 5 of the charter questions. These are questions about providers, applicable also to the UDRP in phase 2 of this PDP. The first bullet is assess the benefit of the arbitration form self-reviews, including the WIPO Advanced Workshop on Domain Name Dispute Resolution, May 2015, in which inconsistencies of decisions, including in the free speech freedom of expression area, were candidly discussed and contemplated. Second bullet, are the processes being adopted by providers of URS services fair and reasonable? With a note that this question also included TMCH and UDRP providers. Third bullet, are the providers' procedures fair and equitable for all stakeholders and participants? The fourth bullet, are the providers consulting with all stakeholders and participants in the evaluation, adoption, and review of these new procedures? And final bullet, what changes need to be made to ensure that procedures adopted by providers are consistent with the ICANN policies and are fair and balanced? Thank you.
Terrific. Thank you. With a note that I think the set of questions continues on the next page, we'll pause here and take a look, again, at a set of questions that, again, at least appears to me, I'm glancing at it for the second time now, that there's questions that are trying to stick with kind of existing policies. Are the providers doing their jobs? And we know that there's a limited set of providers for the URS that does not include the World Intellectual Property Organization. And so looking at these questions, does anyone want to offer any comments? George, go ahead, please.
George Kourikos again. I think the much more broader question is, under what conditions should providers be terminated or decertified or whatever the appropriate language is. As we've seen in the case of the National Arbitration Forum, there were complaints by the Minnesota Attorney General that forced them to leave commercial credit arbitration for consumers. And so it's very disturbing that on the one hand, you have that scenario, but on the other hand, they're still doing disputes, handling disputes for the UDRP and the URS. So there seems to be a disconnect that they've been under investigation in one context, but under the UDRP, URS, they've never been faced with the same kind of review. Thank you.
Thank you, George. And that might apply to some of the data gathering that would be involved with some of these questions, perhaps. Brian, go ahead, please.
Thanks, Kathy. Brian Beckham for the record. For this slide, this is questions on slide 4 out of 5. The second, third questions, they ask about processes adopted by providers, procedures being fair and equitable. This goes to kind of my more overarching comment in the beginning of the call, was that, on their own, these could be fair questions, but it would be useful to understand, were these directed at a particular provision, a supplemental rule, a practice of a provider? So it's difficult to answer the question without understanding a little bit more what was the intent behind the question itself. And then in terms of the final two questions, and I wouldn't want to put her on the spot, but I'm sure Christine would have some views on this as well, Christine Durain. You know, it's an interesting question, but ultimately I think there needs to be some degree of recognition that when it comes to a provider managing its internal operations, that some degree of deference is warranted. You know, there's a fine balance to strike in terms of providing through URS or UDRP policy and rules and supplemental rules, providing a framework under which providers are meant to operate and the legal framework which parties are meant to address the issues before them, and kind of micro-legislating in a way that hinders the ability of a provider to efficiently provide its services. Thanks.
Wait, Brian, before you leave, is there a difference between looking broadly at how, I mean, since we're the first ones through, the URS is a new process, is there a difference between looking broadly at how a URS provider is providing its services versus kind of the micromanaging? Isn't our job as a review team to do, I mean, if no one, you know, is there anyone else looking at the providers? Isn't that part of our job? And, you know, I'd like asking this to you because I'm not asking it to you since you're not providing URS services. So, again, is there a difference between looking at kind of broadly at the providers and how they're implementing to see if anybody's way off base, for example, versus the micromanaging? If Brian is still there, I'll let him come back on. Otherwise, we'll go to Susan. Susan, go ahead, please.
Thanks, Kathy. I actually put my hand up before you asked that question, and it was to kind of to answer that question in a way or to give my thoughts on it. I'm not sure that this is our job to be reviewing the URS providers. I mean, we're tasked with reviewing the RPMs. And I think, you know, and you know, whether the RPMs are serving their purpose and so on. The URS providers are following a set of rules, or the US providers are given a set of rules by ICANN that they're meant to be following. And unless we've got some evidence that one or all of the providers, some evidence has come to light already and is very clear that they're not doing what the policy what the rules and the policy says they should be doing, I'm not really sure that it's our place to be kind of the compliance team for US providers. Surely that is the job of ICANN and ICANN compliance. You know, so our job is to look at, you know, whether the RPMs are working. It's not, I don't think it's really our job to be going, you know, is it appropriate that the forum has been selected, or, you know, has the forum done something wrong? But I'd love to know what other people think.
I would certainly love to know what other people think as well. Jeff and Phil, I don't know if you want to comment on this or something else, but Jeff, go ahead, please.
Yeah, thanks. I was just going to raise the issue I kind of raised on the list, and which was that I think the original GNSO recommendation, I'm trying to find it in going through the report, did call for providers to be under formal contract with ICANN. And
that's my memory as well, Jeff.
Yeah, and so I want to find the exact provision. For whatever reason, ICANN didn't implement that. They did some modified MOU. I want to find out the rationale. Not that there's been necessarily any issues, but I do think that because the previous policy had specifically called for an agreement, that we should either ratify what's going on now, which is, you know, an MOU is okay, or we should, you know, basically find out, you know, why ICANN did what it did, figure out if there's any evidence of a problem, and if so, then address those problems. But we do need to do something because right now the policy says one thing and ICANN implemented something else. I'm not trying to put any judgment on that, saying whether that was good or bad. I'm just trying to say that we need to put the policy recommendations in line, or I should say, put what's going on in line with the policy recommendations and vice versa. Thanks.
Thanks, Jeff. I'm just going to agree with you, not as chair, but as an individual, and also note that we did talk extensively on similar issues, kind of what the policy was versus implementation with Deloitte when we were looking at sunrise period. Phil, go ahead, please.
Yeah, thank you, Kathy. I'm going to disagree somewhat with what a statement made by Susan a couple of minutes ago. I don't have any evidence that the U.S. URS providers are not complying with the applicable requirements for administering the URS, and those requirements can be found in the rules contained in the applicant guidebook, the procedures for implementing those rules that were subsequently issued by ICANN, and in the MOU, which is kind of a rudimentary contract, maybe not as far as some people would have wanted ICANN to go, but is more than they have with UDRP providers. They've actually entered into separate agreements with each URS provider. For the Trademark Clearinghouse, we reviewed the rules for what could be registered there, and even without overwhelming evidence that Deloitte or IBM were acting in noncompliance, well, we reviewed that to make sure they were only allowing marks that should be registered to be in the database. And I think we don't have to do a full compliance review, but I think we have some responsibility as a working group to familiarize ourselves with the basic requirements for the provider set forth in the guidebook, the rules, and the MOU, and ascertain, and in many cases it's not a heavy lift to ascertain whether they're in compliance. It can be done fairly quickly, but to make sure that it's actually being administered in a way that's consistent with the framework that's been set forth by the community. And finally, while it's not before us in this question, there's a major overarching question of whether at the end of this phase one, this working group is going to recommend any of the new TLD RPMs to become consensus policy. And the one that's most clearly would be applicable to legacy TLDs is the URS. Many of the others only apply to the initiation phase of new TLDs. They wouldn't, there'd be no way to make them applicable. But I think if we're going to deal with that big question of whether something like the URS should be extended to over 100 million legacy domains, I think it's incumbent that we take some look to assure ourselves that this RPM is being administered in a manner that's consistent with the rules created by the community. Thank you very much.
Okay. Before I call on George, thank you, Phil. I'm going to note that there was so much interest in the charter questions that we have a second page of questions on providers. So I'm hoping everyone is looking at page 5 of 5 as we're listening to comments. And quick comments, please, so that we can get to the end of the slides. George, go ahead, please.
George Kirikos again. Two related questions to add to this section, namely, to what extent is there forum shopping for URS providers? And that exists because it's the complainant who picks the provider, not the respondent, the domain name owner. And to put that in context, we know from the UDRP, due to some good research, academic research by Professor Michael Geist, that there were very serious concerns about forum shopping under the UDRP. And so we should examine that with regards to the URS. And the second related question is whether the current practice of the complainant choosing the UDRP provider is appropriate, or whether it should be the respondent, i.e. the domain name owner, who should be the one to select the provider in order to obviously reduce the effect of that forum shopping. Thank you.
George, before you leave, I think you meant URS provider in this case, right? Not UDRP.
Right, URS provider.
Good. Okay. So kind of a question you might add, let me see if I can help you with phrasing, might be, you know, is there a problem with forum shopping? You know, I don't know. Actually, let me let you put it into I'll let you phrase it. But based on, you know, the Jeff Newman model, is there a problem under the existing rules that can be established? And if so, what might be the solution? Might be a good way to phrase it if when you go onto the list. Paul, Susan, and then let's see if we can wrap up the charter questions. Go ahead, please, Paul.
Thanks. Paul McGrady here. I just want to throw my voice behind in support of those who are concerned that we are going outside of the scope of what we need to do here. We're here to evaluate policy. We're not here as a compliance wing of ICANN. We're not a compliance review team. If there are specific about providers, then I think those can be referred to ICANN, but we're here to review the policies to see if they're working or not working. And so we have resisted, going out and looking at other things that were outside of the scope of what we should be doing, and this is squarely outside of what we need to be up to. Secondly, even if we do go down this path, which shouldn't, but if we do, these questions, a lot of them are just essentially written with an obvious bias. So, for example, take a look at the last bullet point on slide 7. What changes need to be made to ensure that procedures adopted by providers are consistent with the ICANN policies and are fair and balanced? Well, okay, so if this presupposes that they're not consistent and they're not fair and balanced because it says what changes are necessary. So, again, this question presupposes an answer to a question that's not been asked yet. So hopefully we don't go down this path, but if we do decide to go down this path and, exceed the four corners of what the GeneSeq Council asked us to do, at a minimum, we need to take a really good look at these questions because these questions are loaded and presuppose things that have not already been essentially found out to be true or false. Thanks.
Before we get to Susan, Julie, can we just go, because we're going to go into time, can we just go to URS Charter Questions 5 of 5, and can you just read those last four questions sent to us by the GeneSeq Council, please?
Thank you, Kathy. This is Julie Hedlund. So reading the questions on 5 of 5, are providers exceeding the scope of their authority in any of the procedures they are adopting? What remedies exist or should exist to allow questions about new policies by the providers offering URS services, and how can they be expeditiously and fairly created, noting that this question also included TMCH and UDRP providers? Are the providers training both the complainants and the respondents and their communities and representatives fairly and equally in these new procedures, and is ICANN reaching out properly and sufficiently to the multi-stakeholder community when such procedures are being evaluated by ICANN at the provider's request? Is this an open and transparent process? Thank you.
Terrific. Thank you, Julie. And let me note, again, as we go into the close of the hour, that there are also, as there have been in every other charter question grouping that we've looked at, if you go on to slide number 9, there are general questions that come out of the charter that might or might not be applicable to this area, to the URS area as well. Susan, thank you for your patience. Go ahead, please.
Thanks. Yeah, I had my hand up, obviously, when we had the previous slide up. It's not particularly relevant which slide was up, but it would have been more helpful to be able to say it at the time rather than have that break. I was going to say something very similar to the lines of what Paul said, so I won't repeat that again. Would like to specifically refer to George and respectfully ask him to stick to the URS. We've already established we're talking about the URS and not the UDRP. So if he's got examples of supposedly problem issues and areas that are relating to the UDRP, this is not the time for them. And we don't need to...
Susan, George already corrected himself on that.
He did not. You corrected him, and he was still making an example based on the UDRP. He wasn't making an example based on the URS. And I'd like him to stop.
Okay. Any further comments, Susan? Apologies for interrupting you.
No, I'm good, thanks.
Okay, George, go ahead, please.
First, because I just don't want to respond to that. It's a perfectly legitimate question to ask, and the data gathering part of this review will obviously address that concern of Susan's. So to say that it's not a legitimate question is entirely inappropriate. Thank you.
Okay, okay. So we are talking about URS. So let's go briefly to slide number 9, general questions about the PDP, general questions from the PDP charter, And these are questions related generally, and you'll see the word RPM is in almost all of them. So as we go through, these will be added, I guess, to the table, and then we'll see which ones go through. Do we have time? Julie, can you just read, because I don't think we've even touched these other relevant or potentially relevant charter questions. Julie, do you want to read slide 9 and slide 10, just so everyone has these in their mind, because if they are applicable to the URS, we need to be thinking about it, and that should take our last 2 minutes. Julie, go ahead, please.
Thank you, Kathy. I'll be speedy. So slide 9, do the RPMs work for registrants and trademark holders in other scripts slash languages, and should any of them be further internationalized, such as in terms of service providers' languages served? Do the RPMs adequately address issues of registrant protection, such as freedom of expression and fair use? Have there been abuses of the RPMs that can be documented, and how can these be addressed? Whether, and if so, to what extent changes to one RPM will need to be offset by concomitant changes to the others? Do the RPMs collectively fulfill the objectives for their creation? In other words, have all the RPMs in the aggregate been sufficient to meet their objectives, or do new or additional mechanisms or changes to existing RPMs need to be developed? Final bullet, should any of the new GTLD program RPMs, such as the URS, like the UDRP, be consensus policies applicable to all GTLDs, and if so, what are the transitional issues that would have to be dealt with as a consequence? Moving to slide 2 of 2, first bullet, do the RPMs work for registrants and trademark holders in other script slash languages, and should any of them be further internationalized, such as terms of service providers languages served? Are recent and strong ICANN work seeking to understand and incorporate human rights into the policy considerations of ICANN relevant to the UDRP or any of the RPMs? Are there any barriers that can prevent an end user to access any or all RPMs? And finally, how could cost be lowered so end users can easily access RPMs?
Terrific. Thanks, Julie. Clearly, some of those actually explicitly reference the URS, and others make reference in general to the RPMs that might be relevant. So something to think about. We are at time now. Let me pause to see if anyone wants to make a last comment. I see other comments being put into the chat. Please put other comments into the list, so that the staff can help create the table. Thank you so much for the hour and a half today. And again, thank you to everyone who participated in Abu Dhabi in person and remotely. Take care, everyone. Goodbye.
Thank you. Once again, the meeting has been adjourned. Thank you very much for joining. As a reminder, please disconnect all remaining lines. Operator Johnny, if you could please stop all recordings. Have a wonderful rest of your day.